hear argument from the Lator in Senior Living Properties.
May it please the Court, Mr. Lee Cameron will present argument for the Lator. The Lator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Lee Cameron, along with my co-counsel Rebecca Alcantar, sitting at the table. I represent Senior Living Properties, LLC, and SLP Management in this matter. In my limited time available for oral argument, I'd like to focus the Court's attention on two aspects of this case. The first concerns the construction of a rule of civil procedure promulgated by this Court, and actually the misconstruction of that rule by both the trial court and by the Title Court of Appeals. And the second aspect is the devastating potential impact of the trial court's order and what that means to this case and other cases. First, focusing on the rule, as the Court is aware from the briefing, my client was ordered to produce various insurance information such as the amount of SIR that had been consumed by the policy and erosion of the policy limits. The way that the Court...
Does gathering up and tendering this information require evaluation on the part of the relator or not?
Evaluation per se, certainly as to the erosion, does not, Your Honor. As to the SIR that had been consumed by that point, that's at least part evaluation because that is directly related to defense counsel's efforts in the case, the expenditures that have gone on, the efforts behind the scenes, if you will, to research the law and interview the witnesses and get up to speed can be directly reflected by the defense costs incurred in that case. So to that extent, it would be.
But with respect to erosion of limits, you can just say, well, there have been this many claims, this many payments, this much insurance.
And that would not, in answer to your question, Your Honor, that would not affect the valuation of the case. Just that one issue. However, there's another part of the court's order that I'll get to that does affect and directly affect the valuation.
And why don't you go and tell us what that is right now so we'll have the lay of the land.
Okay, I'll be happy to, Your Honor. Part of the court's order, the trial court's order, was that to produce a witness to testify as to the effect of any pending litigation that would affect coverage. That directly affects or impacts the valuation of both the counsel and the client as to the impact of that pending litigation on their coverage. And as I mentioned, I'll get to that later in my argument.
Isn't there a chance that opposing counsel has proposed?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Isn't there a chance that opposing counsel has waived some of this or clarified it? I mean, the order of the trial court may have gone beyond what they were actually seeking or what they would seek.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's another part I meant to get to, but that's exactly what happened, and that's one of our points. In fact, that's our due process point. Since the court asked the question, I'll go ahead and address that now. What happened in the court below?
But if the other side's waived that and said they're not going to ask for it, we don't think the Constitution hadn't necessarily been trampled upon.
Well, I don't understand the waiver argument by the other side, Your Honor.
Well, it's just something I kind of picked up from the briefs. Maybe we'll learn more.
But addressing that aspect of the order while it's on everyone's mind, what happened in the court below is there was another defendant there that was also subject of the motion to compel, which brings us here. There's another company called Complete Care Services, and they had some related entities. They were represented by separate counsel. Complete Care, or one of their affiliates, had been involved in a separate federal court lawsuit with these insurance carriers over coverage. The plaintiffs in the court below moved to compel certain information from Complete Care, not my client, but Complete Care, as to information with respect to that lawsuit. During the argument, as it's clear from the transcript that's in the record, I was there and I had the pleasure of representing my client back here. I stayed silent because, in the vernacular, frankly, we didn't have a dog in that fight. That was between the plaintiffs, that was between Complete Care. We weren't involved in the federal court lawsuit whatsoever. The motion was not aimed at us on that. At the end of the argument, the court's ruling was a little broader. The oral ruling of the court at that time brought us within the umbrella. We were to produce a witness that basically could tell the plaintiffs if we were involved in the federal court lawsuit. That's it. I had no complaint about that. But the order that was slipped, the written order that was slipped to the trial court for entry by the plaintiffs in the underlying case included the language, effect of any pending litigation that would affect coverage. That is far broader than anything that was asked for in the motion to compel.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you have any complaint or any problem with explaining to them whether or not, to the extent that your client is involved in the federal court litigation?
Your Honor, absolutely not.
All right, and do you have any problem with explaining to them whether or not your policies are eroding so that they can determine how much coverage there is available in this case?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's one of the problems.
You do have a problem with doing that, with telling them how much coverage is available?
Yes, I do, Your Honor, and that's one of the reasons we're here. First of all, it's not relevant under the rules. It's well outside the scope.
Well, I know, but for purposes of them determining how much coverage there is, there may be a face value on the policy per occurrence in the aggregate. But if that amount has eroded and is gone so that there is no coverage, are you going to tell them that? Do you have a problem with telling them that there, in fact, is no insurance coverage? I'm just trying to understand how you're going to settle a case if both sides don't. If that is a possibility, how you're ever going to settle a case. If it's not on the table, how much coverage is available?
In Your Honor's hypothetical, the policy was completely eroded, and under that situation, I would not have any difficulty telling that to anyone on the other side, and I would even recommend my client that they do so because it's in their interest. But when we're dealing with the policy at issue in this case, which was not fully eroded, I have a serious problem with doing that because it directly, the erosion is directly tied to any other settlements.
But as I understand it, you were not ordered and they're not asking you to say exactly how much was paid in a particular lawsuit or how much attorney's fees were being paid in a particular lawsuit. They're looking at the information it would take to ascertain how much coverage remains under the policy.
Your Honor,
am I wrong on that?
Well, Your Honor, it's a smokescreen because
Let me ask you this. Let's say that that's what they want. They don't care if you pay $10,000 to this claimant and $5,000 to that one. They want to know how much the policy is eroded to determine how much coverage is left. Do you have any problem with doing that?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because it ties directly to the amounts paid by this example, my client in settlement. And if I may, I explain by example how that can happen with the policy at issue in this case. This policy has a $3 million aggregate limits and a $1 million per occurrence limit. There are, in fact, this is a good example for the court, there are, in fact, two cases from the same nursing home in Gilmer, Texas. If we are required to disclose erosion, as soon as the first case settles, we get a discovery request. It might be from this set of plaintiffs, it might be from another set of plaintiffs, but if we have to divulge that information, the erosion of that policy, it will tell them to the penny how much we paid to settle that case. All you have to do is take the $3 million aggregate limit, deduct the, or in the case of one settlement, go by the erosion, that tells you, or in the case of multiple settlements, you can go by the aggregate limit less the erosion divided by the number of settlements, and that's all information. These lawsuits are a matter of public record.
See, if our rules require the disclosure of settlement amount, this problem would go away.
I'm sorry?
If our rules require the amounts of settlement to be disclosed, your problem would go away.
That's correct, Your Honor, and there is a rule that does make settlement agreements discoverable if they are relevant to the dispute. The erosion of insurance policies here and the amounts paid in settlement are not relevant to this medical malpractice claim. But that is why, Your Honor, I have
let's say the court orders you to mediation. I just don't know, and you really go in wanting to settle the case, and the plaintiff really wants to settle the case. I don't understand how that case is ever going to settle if it is not made clear to the parties, both sides are clear and the mediator is clear about how much insurance coverage remains that can be paid. I don't understand how you're ever going to do it.
Your Honor,
I understand your concern about you don't want anyone to know that you paid this person $500,000 because then they're going to ask for $500,000 over here and that you're trying to protect those specifics. But on a more general level, I don't really understand how a case could ever be resolved short of trial without that information being available.
Your Honor, 2 points in response. First of all,
this is just a practical question.
I understand it, and I'm trying to give you a practical answer. First of all, again, using this policy as an example, there's a $1 million per occurrence limit. If the erosion thus far is in excess of that, then the $1 million is still there. And it would be up to the insured at that point, as a mediation strategy, to elect to divulge it or not. But flipping that, the bigger and the larger issue is if we are required to, under situations like this, disclose the erosion of insurance policies, by the example I gave the court a few minutes ago, you can get an exact amount of settlement from an erosion. That would then have a chilling effect on future settlements and actually will result in more protracted litigation. And in fact, the court recognized the chilling effect in the foreign motor case that we've cited in the brief of divulging settlement amounts in cases where they weren't relevant. In this case, Your Honor, to the court, this...
What is the answer? I still don't understand the answer to Judge Hankinson's question. How will you settle the case if you don't tell at some point? Don't you have to tell at some point or not?
Well, Your Honor, if in negotiations, which is nip and tuck, the insured has the right to divulge that information and can elect to divulge it as a negotiating strategy. There's nothing that we're asking the court to do that would prevent an insured from doing that voluntarily. The problem is if the insured is required to do it mandatorily, and the information that we'll give to other claimants as to the amounts paid in settlement in other cases, which then will have the chilling effect that this court noted in foreign motor. And this is really, this case and this issue can really be decided just by construction of the rules of civil procedure promulgated by this court just a few years ago.
Can you not think of any situation in which this information would be relevant to the underlying suit?
It could be, Your Honor. Not in this case or a case like this, which is a medical malpractice claim where coverage is not in dispute.
I'm talking about even when, regardless of coverage, or, I mean, what if there were a gross negligence punitive damages claim? Don't you need to know, for punitive damages purposes, what's it going to take to punish, deter? Don't you need to know how much a company is covered by insurance, how much is not, what it's going to take to send a message, the typical sort of components we look at to determine punitive damages?
I agree with you, Your Honor, and I agree also, I'm going to point out to the court that that is exactly the type of information that this court has allowed discovery of in the rules. You start with the general proposition under Rule 192.3A that the scope of discovery is relevant information, which includes information that's reasonably calculated to lead to discovery of admissible evidence. In a case like this, a medical mal case where the insurance coverage is not at dispute, there's no dispute here that this information is not relevant to the underlying case. So the question is, how do you get it? You get it by going to subpart F of that rule that this court promulgated, which allows for the discovery of the existence and contents of an insurance.
Now, I understand that, but there could be an argument made in a case. I understand you're saying it's not made in this case. But this type of information could be relevant to the underlying litigation if someone were to claim it was relevant to the determination of punitive damages.
And, Your Honor, we're not in here asking this court for a blanket rule that this information is never discoverable in any case. That's not what we're in here doing, because we recognize, and in fact, I believe that we allude to it in our briefs, that in the right kind of case, this might be relevant. For example, an insurance coverage case.
You still haven't answered my question. Are you saying that it would be relevant if punitive damages were sought in this case?
In this case, no, Your Honor, because the same analysis as to what insurance information is relevant under the rules would apply that I mentioned a minute ago. And in terms of the punitive damages exposure, that's taken care of two ways. One, the policy is subject to production, which will provide the court and will provide the parties with the aggregate limits and also the per occurrence limit. And that per occurrence limit is going to apply whether it's punitive damages or not, historic punitive damages.
So are you conceding in 192.3F that perhaps there's something more than extent and contents that might be available to discover.
No, Your Honor, absolutely not. What I am conceding is, in the right case, which is not this case, where insurance coverage is at dispute, you don't even get to subpart F. The insurance information that's at dispute is before this court becomes relevant and discoverable under subpart A in that situation.
What you're arguing, I mean, your point is not the breadth of the exception to the relevance part. What you're saying is that if this information they seek is relevant or leads to discoverable information, it's producible. That's not what we're arguing about. What we're arguing about is how broad is the exception to the information needing to be relevant to the underlying litigation. Subpart F is actually an exception. It permits discovery of information that is not relevant to the underlying litigation, and that's this insurance policy, the existence and its contents. And the argument is how broad is that exception to the need to be relevant to the underlying litigation. And if you're not conceding that this exception is broad, what you're saying is you beg the question by saying, well, if it's relevant to the underlying litigation, well, then you don't reach the exception.
That's right, Your Honor. If it's relevant, you never reach the exception because it becomes relevant and discoverable under subpart A of the rule. The exception, on the other hand, drafted by this court, is unambiguous, and it says, and it limits the discovery to the existence and contents of the agreement.
Which is unrelevant by definition. You don't reach it unless it's not relevant.
What's the purpose of the F exclusion in the first place, the existence and contents of coverage?
It's to promote settlement, Your Honor, but if I'm out of time, but if I could expand my answer.
But why does it help you in a case to know if it... Why is the fact that there was at one time $3 million of coverage of any help in promoting settlement? I mean, isn't the settlement promoted by knowing how much coverage is available now?
Your Honor, the way that I would ask the court to look at it is coming at it from a really different angle, and that is the adverse effect it would have on settling other cases and the chilling effect it would have on settling other cases if the erosion information is divulged. Because as I've indicated to the court, it's a very simple calculation, especially in this case where you have two claims, you have a $3 million aggregate limit. First one settles, you search discovery, you find out what the erosion is, and you know to the penny.
I understand that point in this particular case, but if there were thousands of cases out there with an aggregate amount, that argument wouldn't apply. You're saying when we look at this, we should not focus as much on what the overall policy of settlement would be as we should focus on the fact that the court chose two words, existence and contents.
I agree, Your Honor, and I would respectfully submit that the court incorporated its policy in determining the language to include the rules, and by omitting in other information or something like that, that it would be apparent from reading the rules and literal meaning of the unambiguous rules that other information was meant to be excluded.
Let me just ask you real quickly. Sure. If the case went to trial and it didn't settle and the plaintiff got a verdict, wouldn't they be entitled to discover this very information?
Your Honor, I haven't researched that, but I will tell you what my sense is. I believe that there is one case that we came across in our research where this type of information was held discoverable by a court, and I apologize, I don't remember whether it was this court or a lower appellate court, but it was post-judgment. And all I can add to that, Your Honor, is that's really not before the court at this time. That situation's not before the court.
Mr. Cameron, you keep saying that you don't want to disclose the amount it's eroded because it will say how much you paid for a particular client. I'm a little bit confused about that. Maybe I don't understand the underlying facts completely, but you were ordered to produce someone to talk about the extent to which insurance has been eroded or compromised, which sounds to me like a total dollar amount, not a tell me how much for each client. So I'm very confused by your argument. Is that kind of a hypothetical that if we go this way, then that's what will happen in the future? Because I was under the impression there are multiple claims here.
Your Honor, in this particular case, the effect of this order, the extent to which insurance has been eroded, will give you the exact amount of any settlement should one of these two cases settle.
So there's only one other case? Is that what you're saying?
There's one other case that I'm aware of.
That's paid?
Well,
where there's a settlement that's been paid?
It's pending. It's pending. And what I'm saying, Your Honor, is and it's pending. It's in the public records. So the counsel for the plaintiffs will know about it. Counsel for the other plaintiffs will know about it. And if there's a dismissal of the settlement, they'll know about it.
But if that's the case, then isn't the person going to testify that it hadn't been eroded? If you have, I mean, I thought the point here was to determine how much had been paid out under the policy, and if nothing's been paid out, what are we arguing about?
Your Honor, if that question were asked right now in deposition, that would be the answer. But also, if the deposition were scheduled, say, for 30 days from now, there would be no fruitful communications with anyone else about settling, because this person then would have to divulge information as required by this court's order.
So we've got to decide whether to give the insurance company the advantage to keep the plaintiff guessing as to how much is available versus forcing the insurance company to reveal what it has paid to settle the case.
And Your Honor, it's not really the insurance company so much as the insured and insurance company. If there's $250,000 SIR in this case, if insured, my client is able to settle a case for less than that amount, then the same type of information can come out, because you'll start with the aggregate limit. There will be no erosion, so these folks, for example, will know it's settled for less than that amount. It's the benefit of both insured and insurer in their negotiating strategy. And
well,
also
that's what I'm saying. It benefits one side at the expense of the other.
Your Honor, that's the way that the rules and were drafted by this court and the balancing act that this court went through. And I would further submit that there's a whole lot of information about us that they may want to know for settlement purposes. That's not relevant, not discoverable, and that's just part of it.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the real party.
May it please the court, Mr. Tim Lee will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. We can clear a couple of things up right out of the box. First, I don't think that there is anything about discovery with respect to the self-insured retention as ordered by the trial court that possibly can result in the disclosure of some sort of evaluative process. The whole point to getting that portion of the order was just to find out if this particular defendant, having trouble triggering their own insurance coverage because they can't afford to pay a self-insured retention. Point number two, with regard to other claims, we are not interested in other liability claims. The argument to the trial court, the trial court's order, and our present intention is to try to find out what is pending that potentially affects the coverage, what coverage litigation is pending against this insured that might compromise the amount of coverage that it has.
So you don't care then about erosion. All you care is that there's a coverage dispute.
We care in terms about overall completion. The question that I was addressing was Chief Justice Phillips' question in response to the argument to the effect of they are trying to find out about other claims with regard to the other claims that will affect coverage.
But in order to get at erosion regarding pending claims, somebody's going to have to evaluate the value of those cases and what the erosion may be. And you can't do that without getting into somebody's assessment of those cases.
All we are asking for is the amount that has been paid out, that is to say, and I'm just learning that apparently it's nothing as we are sitting here, the amount that has been paid out that would deplete the limits which will remain that cover this claim, and the number of claims, and I've also just learned there's only one other of those. I've now, today, learned a whole lot more about the actual state of the insurance coverage in this case than we had succeeded in learning in about the previous 12
Mr.
months.
Lee, let me ask you, there's been a lot of discussion about the policy behind this exception, but where my concern goes to is the construction of the rules. It looks to me that if any of this the rules are in discovery are very broad, if it's relevant to the underlying litigation, or if it leads to admissible evidence, it's discoverable. So that's a very broad open discovery. It seems that subpart F acknowledges we're going to make an exception to the relevance. We concede that the insurance policy and its contents is not relevant to the underlying litigation. But because of some overriding policy concern, we're going to allow the claimant to compel this information to be disclosed, even though we concede it's not relevant. Why should the court read that exception broadly rather than narrowly?
I don't think that the Tyler court read that exception broadly. I think that the Tyler court read the exception in the context of if you have a case like our case where there are facts that indicate that the policies themselves do not accurately tell you what the coverage available is, you can go further.
But isn't that going back and reconsidering how broad the exception should be as opposed to focusing on the language? You have the existence of an insurance policy and you have the contents of an insurance policy. Didn't the Tyler court really say, but really what this exception is trying to do, we want to inform the parties about how much insurance coverage there is. Well, wasn't, admittedly, those two words don't really say that's what you get. It's kind of an overlay of some sort of policy consideration that should have been decided by the court when it promulgated the rule and chose not to say what's discoverable is the amount of insurance coverage still available. We didn't say you could get that. We limited it to just, you got a policy, you got to show it to them.
I agree with all of that. Can we get back
into the policy arguments now?
I agree with all of that. The policy behind disclosing insurance policies and indemnity agreements is first expressed in 1970 in the Federal Rules Advisory Committee notes to the 1970 changes. And our rules with regard to this issue have tracked the federal rules almost exactly up until 1993, where there's a bit of divergence. In 1970, the advisory committee said that the courts everywhere are split on the discoverability of insurance at all. We think that the overriding policy is that knowing insurance information, and they're just talking about policies at this point in time, facilitates trial and settlement strategy, that it's a practical business, that claimants are not going to be pursuing defendants who can't potentially pay a judgment either through their own assets or through insurance assets. So we're going to allow disclosure of insurance policies. This court follows that rationale in 1973 in Carroll Cable Company versus Miller, which again is just an insurance policy case. But in Carroll Cable Company, the court says, in essence, we know that it's not relevant in the sense it is not going to be admissible in trial. But it is relevant in the sense that the parties, the claimants, need to know what insurance is available.
Well, let's talk about that. You can discover their net worth, I presume.
Yes, that's correct.
So you know that either they have something above and beyond the policy to pay a judgment or not.
Yes.
And so you also know that they've got up to $1 million of coverage. And now you're kind of gambling. How much do they have up to the million? And you know what they have beyond the million, why do you have to get down to the exact dollar amounts to be able to negotiate a settlement?
Until this morning, it was unknown to the claimants whether we were talking about $1 million worth of insurance coverage or $500,000 worth of insurance coverage or $150,000 worth of insurance coverage.
As I understand it, they had no problem with giving you the policy, which would show you policy limits. What they don't want to tell you is the extent of erosion.
Right.
And why is it that you're entitled to detailed information about erosion when you have their net worth available to you, you know what they're worth, and you know that they have it up to $1 million. Now, the unanswered question from your side is how much, if any, of the million do they have to pay you? But why do you have to have that information to negotiate a settlement?
Justice Hankinson is exactly right. I am not going to settle with a defendant who I do not know whether they've got an ability to pay $150,000.
You know what their net worth is, don't you? You can find that out.
In this case, the net worth is zero. This insured is in bankruptcy, and that exacerbates the entire problem. I have got to know how much is out there in insurance proceeds, because that's the only thing I can collect in this case.
Do you agree that generally you shouldn't get to know information that will reveal the other side's settlement strategy on multiple claims, whether it's on the plaintiff's side or the defense.
Absolutely.
How do we prevent that here? I mean, what is the relator says, as soon as we settle one of these cases and tell the other side what you want to know, you'll know what we settle for. And so you're not going to take any less, or at least you're not going to ask for less. You're going to say, pay me what, at least what you paid them.
I don't see that the problem would have existed had SLP actually complied with the trial court's order, because what we would have been told at that point in time, had there been compliance, there is zero erosion. Apparently there are two claims competing for that. And with regard to erosion and competing claims, that's all we asked for, and that's all the trial court awarded us. At that point in time...
But you've got a duty to supplement, right? They've got a duty to supplement. So if they settle the other claim, and then they supplement their answers and tell you, now that they have only $2.1 million left, you'll know they'd settle one for $900,000.
That is correct. And
so then you'll say, pay us $900,000. If they come back and say, well, we got 2.92 left, then you'll say, I don't want you to see. Say, well, our claim's worth a whole lot more than that.
I think that, realistically speaking, when you get to the settlement portion, somebody's going to tell us how much insurance is there when you actually get to settlement, because otherwise, from a practical standpoint, you can't settle a case when you don't know how much is out there, unless your demand, unless our evaluation happens to be within whatever is available to pay it. The risk, and I realize I'm not answering your question, I'm working around to the answer. The risk, if you do not divulge to the claimant how much real insurance coverage there is out there, if the claimant hangs up on $5 million as a demand, instead of the $1 million or $750,000, which is the only thing that they can pay. That's where the process falls apart. A couple of steps in front of it, it falls apart because we spend a lot of money litigating with SLP, and they spend a lot of money defending themselves, and in truth, we don't have that big of a claim against them because they can't pay it.
That's, why would they do that?
I don't know. I'm not sure why we're here.
No, but I mean, generally speaking, if coverage were being eroded, seriously, and there were no other assets to pay, why would somebody continue litigation trying to make the other side spend money for no purpose? Looks like you'd be spending money too, and you just say, King's X, let's all go home.
And the answer to that question, at least the practical answer from down in the trenches, is because it's the carrier that controls the defense, and the carrier's motivation may be different, may be motivated by a different set of economic justifications than the insured's motivation. There is no rational reason, if the insured is paying the bills, for the insured to continue to fight a futile fight. And there is no rational reason for the claimant, as far as that goes, to spend a ton of money pursuing insurance coverage that ultimately turns out to be illusory, because while the policy said there was $1 million worth of coverage, the truth of the matter was there was only $500,000. The whole point of the rule is to serve settlement trial strategy. And the court has made, following virtually every state, and certainly the federal rules, has made the choice that that is at least important enough to allow the plaintiff insurance policies and indemnity agreements as a matter of right. Everyone who asks for those gets those.
But you also agree that you also agree with the chilling effect. I mean, if that information divulges settlement strategies, then it has the reverse effect. It makes it harder to negotiate a settlement rather than easier, because then people start thinking in terms of floors and ceilings, and the world that you can negotiate from becomes a smaller place.
I don't know if I agree with that actually happens in reality or not. If what does happen in reality for sure is where there is not enough coverage or there is no coverage, litigation tends to go away. If I'm the plaintiff, which I am in this particular instance, I evaluate my case as being worth X amount of money. I then evaluate the ability to collect it using the best data that I have available to me. The insurance information is useful to me in a number of ways. You know, it obviously tells me.
Let me ask you about that data. The broad exception to this broad allowance, it's pretty easy to determine whether you've got an insurance policy and the contents of the policy. The policy speaks for itself. Wouldn't we be in a real briar patch if we said you can, as a part of this, also get the erosion that occurred for the arguments? Well, was this, what is this true erosion that occurred here? Did you really pay this amount, or has this been kind of set? Do we end up with, in depositions, basically litigating over whether there's been an erosion here and how much it has been, and does it really count against, say, a deductible, or does it count against a per occurrence or a maximum? Do we find ourselves actually litigating over the extent of erosion if we say erosion is a relevant inquiry as a part of an underlying litigation?
I don't think so, at least not from the claimant's standpoint, because what the claimant is interested in is what does the insurance carrier say is left on the policy.
But would you be entitled to command from the insurance carrier proof of the claims that it says are existing, or would you be able to entitle from them the settlement document that proves up how much they say it's been eroded? Or do you have to accept what the insurance company tells you is what they've paid out?
We are certainly not asking for that sort of more in-depth information. We're not interested in it. It doesn't seem to me like a claimant ordinarily is going to be entitled to that sort of in-depth information.
But if we say information regarding what's left in the insurance policy, doesn't that necessarily implicate the right to seek documents supporting that information?
The trial court, of course, has got the ability to cut discovery off anytime the trial court feels like the parties are getting too far afield. My gut-level reaction is, to your hypothetical, is that I'm having a hard time conjuring up a situation where a claimant has a bona fide interest in, as it were, going behind the testimony as to how much is left on the policy, or going behind the testimony as to there's been a reservation of rights letter issued, and here it is. I guess it is theoretically possible, and I would hate to see the court as a matter of law cut off that theoretical possibility, but I think from a practical standpoint, when you're in the position that we're in this case, what you're interested in finding out is the coverage really there? How much of the coverage is really there? And who else is chasing the coverage?
Mr. Lee, would you very succinctly take us through Rule 192 and tell us how Part A and Part F interact so that under the language of the rule, you are entitled to discovery of this information?
Part A provides the general grant of discovery, and it says in general, and we know that what in general you get is information that is relevant to the claims or defenses of a party, or information which is likely to lead to discovery, reasonably calculated to lead to discovery of admissible evidence. This is not either one of those things.
Well, it's subject matter, too. Relevant to the subject matter, right?
Yeah. Subject matter,
it's relevant to the subject matter, whether it relates to a claim or defense.
Whether it relates to
And it is clear that in this case, the way this mandamus has come up, that the presence or absence of insurance doesn't relate to a claim or defense.
Okay.
The more specific areas within the rule allow you to discover what the wording is, existence and content. And the reason the wording is that way is because that wording has been carried through since the 1970 federal rules changes. I don't think that there is any indication that there's a calculated decision that has been made to restrict existence and content. And I'd like to make a comment.
And so how do we interpret existent and content to include the information about erosion and number of claims competing for the remaining coverage?
I think the rationale is very simple. In the situation where there's an indication that the policies, the existence and the content of the policies, don't tell you the truth, you get an opportunity to go a little bit farther and find out what is the real coverage that is there. Let me comment real briefly.
Let me ask you real quick for the record. You seem to be pursuing the position in this court that you are entitled to know about pending litigation that has not been settled and the potential effect on coverage of those cases. Is that correct?
We are arguing that we are entitled to know about potential claims, pending claims, competing for the remaining coverage.
And how is it that you're going to determine the potential impact on coverage remaining of potential claims? Who's going to put a dollar value on those pending claims?
I don't think we expect that to happen. What we're interested in finding out, there's $3 million out there apparently. It makes a big difference if there are two claimants chasing it or if there are 15 claimants chasing it. And that's what we are interested in. It's an order of magnitude kind of question. That's what we are interested in.
But the order says the effect, if any, of any pending litigation that would affect coverage in this case. And knowing they're 15, if the claims are $100 a piece, that's $1,500. If they're $1 million a piece, that's a different thing. How do you put a dollar amount to determine the effect on coverage of pending claims?
I answered the question that I thought you were asking, but that is not the question you were asking. Section C of the order, which is the section that talks about pending litigation, it is our position, is referring to coverage litigation. That's all that we are seeking. And that was motivated by the federal case pending down in Galveston, where policies with the same numbers as these policies, different insured, the same numbers, were voided out by Sam Kent. That's all that C is pointed at. And while the Chief Justice may be right, it may be drafted somewhat more broadly than that. That's all we were interested in with regard to C. All we want to know is how much insurance is there, how many other claims are pursuing it, is there some impediment to coverage, and is there some problem that this insured has triggering coverage because of self-insured retention. At the end of the day, what the plaintiffs in this case are looking to find out is what ordinarily you find out as soon as you get the insurance policy. That is, how much coverage is there, and how do we build our lawsuit around that fact of life? In the vast majority of situations, that question will be answered just by giving the policy. But in some situations, it won't. And in those situations, it seems to me like this court ought to interpret its rules the way the Federal Advisory Committee has interpreted to say you can go a little further.
I'm not sure if you completed answering my question about how you would have us interpret F so that your request does come within the scope of discovery. Maybe you did, and I'm just not sure.
I'm not sure either, so we share confusion on the point. If you have a situation where there is an indication that the policy does not tell you, does not tell the claimant what the available coverage is, then I think in order to effectuate the purpose of disclosing the policy, you have to let the claimant discover the true facts of the situation a little further than looking at the policy. And I realize that is not a strict and literal reading of the rule.
But you believe it comes within the language using the rule? Is that your position? Or are you asking us to really go outside the rule?
I am asking the court to implement the purpose of the rule. Otherwise, in the cases where you need it the most, it doesn't work. And that doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Thank you.
So the real question is Judge Enos' question. Should Rule 1, I guess it's still there, we apply these rules liberally, but should that apply to an exception to the general relevance rule? Or does it apply to all rules, including this one? And construe it liberally to achieve the ends, just ends, and purposes.
I would disagree slightly to the extent that we're characterizing. That's correct. That's a fair statement. And I don't think there's any real disagreement that Rule 1 is going to apply to all the operations rules of civil procedure. We're trying to get the system to function as effectively and fairly as it can. And in this set of circumstances, by not giving exclusion F a crabbed or mechanical sort of reasoning, you are effectuating the policy that animates subsection F to begin with.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
We've got two competing policies here. The rule on insurance policies, I think, clearly contemplated that a plaintiff could find out how much coverage would be available for their claim. On the other hand, we've got a policy that you don't generally get to know what the defendant has paid to others in settlement. Now, how do we pick between those two competing policies?
Thank you, Your Honor, and I would submit you've got a third competing policy, is that you will promote settlement by not making any rulings that would impose a chilling effect on the settlement. And I think the way that you, in answer to Your Honor's question, is I think the court has done that. You have balancing of interest. There's no doubt that the insurance policies themselves in this case and the contents in existence are not relevant to this case. The court, when promulgating these rules, balanced the interest and decided in order to promote settlement, we're going to allow discovery of this information. It's balancing those interests. And the other impact, or the other potential impact, is what I've argued earlier, Your Honor, is if you allow this order to stand like it is, where the erosion can come in, then it's quite a simple calculation to find out how much one has paid in settlement of a prior case, which will then cause a chilling effect on future settlements and result in protracted litigation throughout the state.
But it'll also chill settlement in this case.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I mean, in this policy, it's a $3 million aggregate of $1 million per occurrence. If there's any erosion down below the $1 million, it would be in the defendant's best interest to divulge that information, which would then encourage settlement. It's only when you have a situation like we have here and where the Court of Appeals, the Tyler decision, can be interpreted so broadly as to include situations like this where the erosion, there's a direct correlation between the erosion on the policy limits and settlement balancing of interest. There's no doubt that the insurance policies themselves in this case and the contents in existence are not relevant to this case. The court, when promulgated these rules, balanced the interest and decided in order to promote settlement, we're going to allow discovery of this information. It's balancing those interests. And the other impact, or the other potential impact, is what I've argued earlier, Your Honor, is if you allow this order to stand like it is, where the erosion can come in, then it's quite a simple calculation to find out how much one has paid in settlement of a prior case, which will then cause a chilling effect on future settlements and result in protracted litigation throughout the state.
But it'll also chill settlement in this case.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I mean, in this policy, it's a $3 million aggregate of $1 million per occurrence. If there's any erosion down below the $1 million, it would be in the defendant's best interest to divulge that information, which would then encourage settlement. It's only when you have a situation like we have here and where the Court of Appeals, the Tyler decision, can be interpreted so broadly as to include situations like this where the erosion, there's a direct correlation between the erosion on the policy limits and settlements of other cases. And as Justice Heck mentioned, there is a duty to supplement. So we've got, and this is a good example again, here in this case, we have two claims.
But this sounds like discovery by control of one party to the litigation as opposed to discovery governed by rules that are to be fairly administered to all parties. I mean, what you're saying is don't make me do it, but when I decide it's okay, I'll do it then. And well, I don't understand how that fits. I mean, it seems to me we've got to balance these things out so that we have a fair administration of the rules through the court system, as opposed to leaving it in the hands of parties to be able, one side or the other, to use it for tactical advantage.
Well, Your Honor, if the ruling is allowed to stand, then the plaintiffs throughout the state will use it for tactical advantage, and it will cause a chilling effect on settlements. But in answer to your question,
come back to my question of what you said earlier in response to the question Judge O'Neill just asked.
Well, in answer to your question, Your Honor, the discovery that's provided by the rules is discovery of relevant information to the subject matter. Anything outside that, any party in the state in any case, my client, anybody else's client, is free to divulge whatever information outside the scope of discovery they want to, and that this decision wouldn't change anything. And I would point, in rebuttal, I would point out, and I think the court may need not go any further than this. The first question Justice Heck asked and Mr. Lee was, do you not care about evaluation? And Mr. Lee did not answer no. Now, that's what this case is about. This order, Mr. Lee says today, that they are not interested in knowing the evaluation claims, well, yet the order entered by the court.
But you also agree that the Court of Appeals has said in its opinion that if the deposition goes too far afield and goes beyond what the defendant believes they would be entitled to if the Court of Appeals position prevails, that that would be the point in time for an objection to be made to the question and a witness instructed not to answer so that the trial judge could have the opportunity to rule on individual objections and protect information that is confidential under any particular privilege or the work product doctrine.
And you
don't disagree with that, do you?
Well, in a way I do, Your Honor, because the particular section, subsection C of the trial court's order that we're talking about here, the effect of pending litigation that would affect coverage. First of all, we didn't have the opportunity in the court below to argue that point for the reasons indicated earlier.
Well, I understand, but you have an order from the Court of Appeals right now that says you can go into the deposition and make your objections if there are particular questions that are asked that are far afield that you believe address privileged information, and that those should be then taken to the trial judge.
But we also have a direct order.
Yes. I mean, you do.
I believe that's the correct interpretation, Your Honor, but it puts the client in that situation between a rock and a hard place, because there's a direct order from the trial court that we are to divulge the effect of any pending litigation that would affect coverage. It calls for that information and evaluation on its face and puts us at the great risk of imposing or incurring sanctions in the trial.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Oyez, 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 the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.